Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And good afternoon, everybody. Thanks for joining us for another live edition of Midrats. If you're new to the show and you don't know the routine, what I'd like for you to do, go ahead and scroll down to the bottom of the show page. That's where you'll find the chat room. And you can fold in with the usual suspects there. In the course of the show, if there's a question you would really like for us to direct to our guests, or if there's just an observation you want to make, that's a great place to do it. Both Eagle One and myself will be monitoring that as the show goes forward. And also, if you need to leave halfway through the show, or if you want to catch up on some previous shows that you may have missed, you can always get the full archive over at Blog Talk Radio. Now let's get on with the show. Like we put out in some of the pre-show materials, even though it was a quarter of a century ago, when you look at the events that led up to and followed when the USS Samuel B. Roberts, FFG 58, when she hit a mine, there are a lot of lessons to be learned, not just about from a strictly historical point of view, but today for today's naval leaders and leadership in general and how our ships operate. And we'll kind of fold in all these things that, even though it was a quarter century or so ago, are still applied today as the show goes forward. And back in 2006, the middle of the last decade, I know a lot of my regular listeners have already read it, but a lot haven't. And our guest today is the author Brad Pennison. In 2006, a hardback copy of the story of the Samuel B. Roberts, No Higher Honor, Saving of the Samuel B. Roberts in the Persian Gulf. Earlier this year, it was reissued on paperback, and it's also last month has come out on Kindle. So, Brad, welcome to Midrats.
Well, thank you guys so much for having me.
Really appreciate you coming on this Sunday. Just as a scene setter, if you could, what was the Samuel B. Roberts, what mission was she doing, and why was she doing it on the days leading up to when she hit the mine?
Sure. Well, you guys will recall that in the 1980s, Iran and Iraq were at war, and they'd been at war through the entire decade. And over the decade, the land battle between these two regional powers had come to a stalemate, and so the battle had swept over to sea, and so both parties were trying to attack the maritime support of each other's battle efforts. And so there's an awful lot that went into this, but to simplify it, I'll just say that finally Kuwait had it with attacks on its shipping, and it raised its hand and said, hello, Washington, can you come over and protect some of our tankers because we're getting blown out of the water here? And Washington looked at this and said, just don't want to get involved quite that much. And the Kuwaitis went back and they said, okay, that's fine. Hello, Moscow, we really need some protection. At that point, Washington said, whoa, ho, ho. Did we say no? We said, well, let's see what we can do. And so was launched Operation Earnest Will. It started to come together in 1986 with the reflagging of a bunch of Kuwaiti tankers under U.S. flags, so that when the U.S. actually deployed warships and warplanes to look out for these ships, they could say that they were doing it over U.S. vessels and not third-party ones. The mission, the operation, actually began in 1987. And wouldn't you know it, on the very first escort mission, you had the tanker Bridgeton being escorted by three Navy warships, and kaboom, huge explosion. The supertanker had hit a mine. And so they came to a full stop. They looked at it. Luckily, the tanker's double hull had stopped progressive flooding, and she was actually seaworthy despite having a giant hole up front. But the picture that then flashed around the world and wound up on the newspaper's front pages the next day was of this tanker breaking trail through the Persian Gulf with the three Navy escorts trailing her. And so this really set the stage for Operation Earnest Will. Navy, U.S. Navy commanders were worried about Iraqi warplanes. And as a matter of fact, you will recall that in 87, one of the ships on Earnest Will, USS Stark, became the victim of an Iraqi warplane. Best we can tell, it was mistaken identity, but it was no less fatal to 37 American sailors aboard the Stark. But anyway, so they're worried about that. They're worried about Iranian warships and, as a matter of fact, armed powerboats. But what really freaked everyone out was the mine, because, of course, when you lay a mine, if you do it right, and especially in a shallow sea like the Persian Gulf, these deadly weapons float invisible beneath the surface, and so you can't see them until they get you. And as a matter of fact, this is what happened to the Bridgeton. So fast forward then to the beginning of 1988, and one of the ships about to be thrown into duty in the Persian Gulf was the USS Samuel B. Roberts. And she was a frigate, as you mentioned, a guided missile frigate, built and designed by Bath Iron Works, and this was her maiden voyage, or at least her maiden deployment. She had, of course, been training up for a couple of years before. And the thing about the Roberts was she was an extraordinary ship. She had gone through Gitmo, and she'd gone through all the workup inspections and exercises and evaluations and had received superb marks. And, you know, I know that when you read Navy evaluation, sometimes there's a little bit of grade inflation there, and you know, everybody is excellent, and if you're a little bit better than excellent, then you're superb. But really, the Roberts had marks on her evaluations like best ship we've seen in years, you know, a ship for everybody else to follow, and all this good stuff. And it was due, really, to leadership from the captain on down, captain, officers, chiefs, everybody who's supposed to lead a Navy warship. The captain was a guy named Paul Rinn, and he had an interesting career because he had started out very early in his career. He'd been part of the groundwater Navy in Southeast Asia, and so he had done more than just stand on the deck of a destroyer, a cruiser, that kind of thing, which every time a ship leaves the port, of course, as you guys know, it goes into harm's way, but there's something a little different about actually being face-to-face, looking over your rifle sight at somebody who's trying to kill you and you're trying to kill them back. And that's the kind of experience that Captain Rinn had early in his career. And so when he got to the Samuel B. Roberts as the commanding officer, he kind of gathered everybody together. And he said, I'm not some guy who just wandered out of the Pentagon. I've actually been in combat, and I've seen what it takes, and I know what it's like to think you're going to die, and I know what it's like to try to kill somebody else. And he said, look, in combat, there's no points for second place, so we are going to be the best frigate in the Navy. No, we're going to be the best ship that ever sailed in the Navy. So he got everybody all psyched up. And there was one other thing, actually, that's kind of interesting. He was a great fan of history. And so when he would talk to his crew, he would evoke everything going back to John Paul Jones to say, look, you know, this is the heritage of the U.S. Navy sailor, and you walk in their footsteps, and you can be proud of what they did before you, and you will make them proud in what you do. And he pointed to the name on the stern of the ship, Samuel B. Roberts, and he said, you know, this guy helped Marines at Guadalcanal. He was part of the force that landed them there. He single-handedly volunteered to be a diversion when they had to be exfiltrated, and he gave his life, basically, trying to draw fire from the Japanese in order to get these Marines off the ship. And so he said, look, even the name on our ship is something to be proud of and to live up to. So he really had this approach to forging his brand new crew. And so, as I said, the crew then duly inspired went on to win, you know, break records. They had more honored graduates from the combat systems schools that they went to. They, you know, had no drug infractions, no disciplinary infractions during the time they were in Norfolk getting ready, you know, waiting for the ship to be built, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Just a superb, superb crew by the time it sailed on February 1988 for the Persian Gulf. So they sail across. They put 2 months. They get into the Gulf. They're sailing around doing great stuff. And then on 14 April 1988, they have dropped off a ship on Kuwait. One of their, you know, they've shepherded a tanker up to Kuwait. They're coming back down to the middle of the Gulf. And the lookout on the front takes his binoculars and he goes, whoa, there's something out there. And, of course, there was always something out there. It was the Gulf. And so there was trash everywhere. And there were, you know, dead sheep that had come over from, you know, New Zealand and, you know, had died on the cargo ships and been thrown overboard. But these were something different. They were shiny. They were bobbing in the water. And so it took about 2 minutes for the captain to get up on the bridge and call all stops. So there they were, a couple of lines out in front of them. And so he said, okay, well, what do we do now? We can't, you know, a ship is not a helicopter. You can't just stay here. You can't drop the anchor and hope everything's going to be okay. So I guess we better try backing down the wake. And so that's what they did. They put their little auxiliary power units in the water. They turned them on, started backing down. And a couple of minutes went by, and kaboom. They hit a mine that they somehow missed on the way in. And that's when they were truly put to the test. So the story of the saving of Kennedy Roberts really begins back with the very beginning of pulling the crew together and saying we're going to do it all right. We're going to train hard. We're going to train every day. We're going to train not just for the glamorous and glorious shooting and finding of enemy warships and warplanes, but we're also going to try. We're going to also work really hard on damage control. And so when it came down to it, and they had a truck-sized hole in their engine room and the keel broken and the ship on fire, they were able to turn to, and you know, over the course of literally 5 hours, up and down, back and forth, and save their ship. And I'll say one more thing. In the aftermath, since then, various naval engineers have tried to figure out how they did it. The ship had, the engine room was flooded, one of the auxiliary rooms was flooded, another of the auxiliary rooms was almost flooded. They managed to patch up the holes and dewater it, but keel was broken, ship was in really bad shape, and these naval engineers, from David Taylor Model Base in Maryland to MIT up in Boston, have tried and failed to figure out how that ship still stayed afloat. So it's really... The story of Samuel D. Roberts is really a story of a well-led crew who responded very, very well to their moment of peril.
I have a lot of questions.
Or I could let you break in and ask stuff.
Okay, well, I have a lot of questions, but how did you get, I mean, this book has been out for a while, I think 2006, I think you said earlier to us, and then it's just come out on Kindle and in a paperback edition. How did you get involved with the writing of this book, and did you have a background in the military, and what got you started on the story of the Samuel B. Roberts and this incident with the mine?
Well, my father was Air Force ROTC, but I didn't have much of a background in the military at all. What I had was a job as the features reporter at the Annapolis Capital newspaper, and I had been writing about Is Milk Good for You, and I think I interviewed all the triplets in town, and then the motorcycle riding cat and all this sort of stuff. And I finally went to the editor and I said, look, you know, this is fun and all, but really, is there some beat that you can give me that actually matters whether I come in every day? And they said, well, what do you know about the Navy? The Naval Academy beat was coming up. And I said, you know, I bet I can learn real fast. And it turned out that actually going from zero to something in knowledge about the military, covering one of the academies is not a bad way to do it, because, of course, they are in the business of taking about 1,000 rank civilians and turning them into proto-officers every year. And so I went to the public affairs office, and I said, hi, I really need some help here. And they said, no problem. And they loaded me up with brief points and the rest of the freshman plebe curriculum. And I kind of learned along with the plebes what it meant to be part of the Navy and what the Navy meant and what the Navy did. And so after a couple of years of that, I moved to Navy Times. I found it especially interesting to really make it a full-time occupation. Went to Navy Times, wrote a book about the Navy in the decade after the Cold War, when the the reason for the every ship had been, every ship in the Navy in 1997, 98, 99 had been built to fight the Soviet Union, and all of a sudden the Soviet Union had gone away. And so you guys will recall, of course, that it was sort of a grab bag of stuff. There was a lot of presence missions. There was Kosovo. There was the aftermath of Desert Storm, the no-fly zone, keeping Saddam in the box. But there was not this big throwdown with the Soviet Navy at sea the way it had been anticipated. And so I set out as a reporter for Navy Times to kind of write a big story, a mile-wide, inch-deep story, I guess, but the story of the Navy after the Cold War. So they called that was put out by the Naval Institute Press, and they called it Around the World with the U.S. Navy, look at the post-Cold War Navy or something like that. So that came out in 99. A few years later, I was talking to the Institute again, and they said, have you heard of the Samuel D. Roberts? And I vaguely said, yes, the ship that hit the mine, right? Something like that. And they said, well, the skipper has just retired, Captain Wren, and he gives a pretty mean luncheon talk, and you ought to go talk to him. He would think about the story of the Roberts. And I said, well, okay, that's fine. So we went off, and we had dinner, and 4 hours later, I was convinced that, yes, here was a story that not only needed to be told, but I was actually quite lucky that no one had gotten a hold of it to that point yet. I mean, you know, you had, I guess, all hands had written up something soon after the mining, and there had been in all the papers, but nobody had written a book about it. And yet there are all these terrific lessons and all these terrific things that nobody quite realized about the ship that made it more than just, oh, the ship that hit the mine. And so I started, so I told the Naval Institute that, yeah, I'd write a book, and I thought that it would take me a year to do the research and a year to do the writing. And I was only off by a factor of two. So I interviewed a lot of people on the ship. I gathered all the documents I could find. I went into the ship's history branch of the Naval Archives in Washington, D.C., and went up to Bath and talked to some of the engineers who both built and designed and then repaired the ship as well. Gathered it all up and then wrote it over the course of nights and weekends and holidays over the next couple of years. And so, like you said, it came out in 2006, and that's the story of how I came to write it.
As a writer and a professional journalist, you know, to create a book like this, you need good characters as you do your research. And I think, you know, you touched on one of the first ones here is when you had that sit down and you talk with the skipper, and you're like, yeah, we've got something here. In the course of your research and getting to know some of the other sailors, officers enlisted on board the Samuel B. Roberts, as a writer, what other characters did you see as this sort of started to flesh out in front of you that really grabbed hold of you and helped you get a grip on the narrative?
Oh, it's a great question, and there are so many great characters. You know, there are the 200 guys aboard the ship, including the air deck. So, of course, you know, the 200 stories, and every one of them could have been its own story, but then you have to pare down. But just a handful of the folks that I felt I found really compelling. Start with the damage control assistant. The first DCA aboard the Roberts was a guy named Eric Sorensen, and he was a senior lieutenant, which is important because correct me if this has not been your experience, but I seem to have found that most of the DCAs, especially on relatively small boys like frigates, are junior lieutenants or ensigns because it's damage control. It's not fire control. It's not weps. It's not some of the things that you know, ostensibly require a little bit more technical knowledge and experience. But that's not how Wren saw it. Paul Wren said, really, if it comes down to it, we are going to need to know how to save the ship, and therefore we need somebody who's, A, more senior and who isn't going to get told by chiefs and other folks who run the ship to pound sand when he wants to run another damage control drill, and also he wants somebody who's been around a little bit. So Sorensen, not only he's a senior Navy lieutenant, but he was prior enlisted in the Coast Guard, so he knew all about small boats and basic deck seamanship. So he came onto the Roberts and he actually was looking for a propulsion job. He wanted to punch that ticket, and he thought that would set him up well for lieutenant commander. And Wren said, no, I need you to because of your experience and also because you are bullheaded, told Lieutenant Sorensen, I need you to be my DCA because we are going to take damage control training seriously on this ship, and I'm not going to have somebody doing DCA who is not capable of doing it. And so Sorensen went off and fumed for, 5 or 10 minutes, and then he came back and said, okay, aye, Captain, that's fine. And so he sat down, and he rewrote the ship's damage control handbook. He took what was several thousand pages, I don't know how long it was, but a long, not too tightly, not at all compellingly written manual, and he slimmed it down. He started with commandments of damage control. He said, thou shalt keep your ship watertight. Thou shalt keep your wits about you, and thou shalt not give up the ship, and 10 of these. And went on to describe the workings of the ship and what it meant to have 11, what was an 11-compartment ship, why you had to dog the hatches after you, and what that really meant when it came down to it. And so he wrote this up, and then he put it into practice, and everybody wound up doing about a damage control drill every shift, every watch, and he really made it happen. And so it was the saying among the crew that he ate damage control for breakfast. And it was, as far as I could tell, it was really true, because he was both an interesting character and absolutely key to the ship in its time of peril. So that was one character. As DCA, Sorensen worked for the Ching, the chief engineer, a guy by the name of Gordon Van Hook, and he had his own interesting background. He was the scion of a Navy family. He had captains and commanders, and I think even an admiral somewhere back in his lineage. And once you got out to Cousins, he had, I don't know, a couple dozen people in the Navy. And yet, he did not start out wanting to go into the Navy. He actually majored in admiral's husbandry at Texas A&M and only found his way to the Navy afterwards. Well, maybe I'll give this family business a try. But he turned out to be great. He turned out to be just a terrific officer. He came on board as plank owner, and he would play games with his engineers. They'd look around this half-built ship as it was rising on the waves of Bath Iron Works, and they'd say, all right, if I kick a hole in this bulkhead, what comes through? Is it air? Is it fuel? Is it water? And by making it a game, it was a little bit more engaging for the folks he was responsible for training. So he was an interesting guy. Staying in the engineering department, he had then two chiefs who were the gas turbine mechanics, one guy electrical, one guy mechanical, of course. And the electrical chief, if I'm getting this right, I forget which one is which, but one of them was Alex Perez, who was by the book. He was terrific at administration. He was a fine leader, but he could really make the trains run on time. And so Van Hook valued him for that. The other guy in this gas turbine split was Dave Walker, who was an administrative disaster, never could get any paperwork done on time, but he was MacGyver on blue water. He was the guy who was Mr. Fix-It. He could get it done when you needed to get it done. So Van Hook had these two guys, was grateful for them, and both of them played their parts after the ship was fine. So those are a couple of the folks at a couple of different levels. And I'll tell you one more. This engine and striker fireman named Mike Tilley. And Tilley is an interesting case. So he was, he was kind of Seaman Schmuckatelli. He was getting into trouble, here and there. Nothing serious, but, he got caught with a fake ID. And I think on leave in the Caribbean at one point, he was part of a gang who let somebody's boat drift off and these things. And so he'd be brought to mast. And after a couple of these, his chief was like, I don't know why we keep him. And Wynn was like, yeah, but he's trying. I mean, he's putting a good effort in. I'm going to give him another shot. So April 14th, 1988, the ship is backing away from these mines, and Tilley is down under in one of the spaces, and kablam, ship hits the mine. And Tilly's job is to go take a look at one of the generators. The ship has four generators. For the FFGs have four generators. And the mine inundated a space that took out two of the generators just like that. It also knocked a third generator offline. And so basically the ship's entire electrical load was on this one generator, and eventually it just browned out. And so the ship was plunged into darkness. And when I say darkness, I actually mean darkness, because it browned out. It didn't black out. There was enough current trickling through the grid that the auxiliary lighting didn't come on. And so everybody underneath grabs for the battle lanterns. And so, okay, well, we can do this. And so Tilly goes off to his generator. And he knows, he is green, but he's not so green that he doesn't know what happens to a ship that's sinking and doesn't have any electricity to run the fire pumps. It just keeps sinking. So he knows he's got to get his generator back up. So there are a couple of different procedures that you can do this. There are the Navy way and the, okay, Navy way that we wink at and we don't do unless we really have to way. And then there's the way that nobody wants to do. So they tried the first two, and then it comes down to the last one, which is what they call a suicide start. You have to climb up on top of this hulking Detroit diesel 16-cylinder turbocharged intercooled diesel engine that runs the generator, and you have to press down on a button that you hope will then spin it up using one of the high-pressure air flasks. And so Tilly, you know, is getting calls saying, Tilly, you got to start this up. He's like, really? We run out of options? And they're like, yeah, Tilly, you got to do this. And so Tilly takes a deep breath. He climbs up on the generator and says, okay, I got to do this or we're all going to die, pushes down on the plunger, and the thing starts up. And hooray. And so the lights come back on. The ship quickly manages to get a second generator up, and that makes all of everybody else's effort to get the fire pump started, to get the space that's starting to be dewatered, et cetera, all flows from this one guy who was given a second and a third chance by the skipper and had just enough training to do what he needed to do. So you ask about stories, and you know, the Roberts was full of them. And it was a real treat to interview these folks and find out their side of the story and then to fit them into the larger story. Because, you know, as you guys are aware, if you're in a ship or even in an airplane, you don't necessarily know what's going on much beyond what you can touch and see sometimes. You know, you're down there below decks and, you know what you're supposed to do and you know what, you know, your folks around you are supposed to do, but you don't really put it together. And so one of the great joys of doing this book was after I had put it together and sort of distilled this massive trauma and great experience into a book, and then some of the crewmen read it, and they're like, huh, I didn't realize all this else was going on. I didn't realize I was part of something so big. And so that was really, I was humbled but pleased by it to tell everybody, to be able to show everybody how their story fed into the larger ones.
As you were working through this book, and you, as I read it, there's a little touching on the fact that the U.S. has lost more ships to mines since World War II than any other form of contact with an enemy. Do you still follow mine warfare? Do you have a feel for where we are with that in the United States Navy? And is this your interest piqued by this book you wrote?
Yeah, I would tell you sort of in broad terms, there was not the kind of attention paid to mine warfare even in the immediate aftermath of the Roberts mining. It was a little bit mysterious to me, but people have said you can't stand on the bridge of a mine, and you know, maybe there was a little bit of institutional myopia. Well, we did this as sort of a one-off, but really we're still a blue water Navy or something. But there was not attention paid for quite some time. But that began to change about a decade ago. The Navy got serious about a number of different mine detection and mine hunting and mine clearing platforms that are now coming online. And in just the past year, sort of following a ratcheting up of tension with Iran that we've been tracking for a couple of years now, there have been two very large multinational exercises, mine hunting, mine clearing exercises in the Persian Gulf. One was last fall, one was just a month ago. And if memory serves, they included something like 40 ships, including more than a dozen from other navies, European and even Middle Eastern navies, all coming together to practice what one does when faced with an opponent who is determined to put mines in the water. So I'm happy to see that. actually, I think, as did a lot of people, that the Navy had neglected mine warfare for too long. And so I'm glad to say and glad to see and glad to report that that things are being righted in that fashion.
When you look at the back at the history of some of the ships that have hit mines, some of them are almost unknown to people. I know the USS Warrington off Vietnam may have struck or been hit by a couple of U.S. mines, but they managed to keep the ship afloat. Did you do any research in the, on the back story of some of the other mine incidents as you were progressing through this book?
Not so much. I relied on a lot of research by Scott Truber, who's a very distinguished naval analyst, and he has written probably the best book on mines. It's called Weapons That Wait, and he wrote it, and he published an updated version maybe a decade later, and that I think is the go-to book for a discussion of mine warfare. He goes into a lot of the individual ships that hit mines more than I did, but he's the one who put it all together, and he has a great PowerPoint slide that shows, you know, ships hit by missile, ships hit by naval gunfire, and then far, far, far more, you know, since World War II, ships damaged or sunk by mines.
I'm glad y'all brought that topic up because, you know, you look at what's lost recently, you know, the Tripoli, the Princeton, Samuel Roberts, not lost, hit, excuse me, and the mines
yep.
keep coming back. And I wanted to go back to something you mentioned early on in this show because it's kind of a pet peeve of mine is, you know, you mentioned early on that the engineers at MIT and elsewhere, they looked at the damage that Samuel B. Roberts took, and they don't know how she stayed afloat. And I think a lot of times when we are evaluating fighting a ship or how a ship is going to fight, we dismiss the human element of it, whether the whole manning design, I don't beat up on a littoral combat ship, but it's very small, very few people on board, watch standing, they already have to try to figure out how they're going to deal with, you know, human fatigue issues. But when you look at how Samuel B. Roberts survived and was able to get home, the human element seems to have a lot to do with it. And there's a big push in discussions about automated damage control being able to take the place of sailors to save their ship. And in research, and if you look at what happened to the Roberts and other ships that have been hit, electrical goes, there's warping, there's torquing, ships and deck are bent into shapes you don't expect them to be. And many times the only thing that's working is leadership, backbones, and sheer force of will. When you look back at how we're trying to identify lessons learned, do we put too much towards the engineering part of it and don't discuss enough about the human element of what it takes to fight or save a ship?
Well, I will tell you this. You just cannot say enough about the human element. You know, in the year after the Roberts was hit, already people were starting to talk about reducing manning on ships and this and that and the other. And there was an article in Naval Institute Proceedings magazine that said, could a lean manned ship have saved the Roberts? And you know, it's addressing that very topic, trying to figure out whether you can actually replace the human brain and human hands that saved the Roberts. And I think it's still an open question. One can certainly do amazing things with automation and redundant systems and all the like. On the other hand, we can look at the Samuel B. Roberts, and there is no question that the reason that the ship stayed afloat is because these guys were trained so well. They were led so well, but more specifically, they were trained so well because when the ship hit and they were in extremis, they reacted not just coolly and not just competently, but they actually reacted creatively. And I'll give you an example. So the Roberts, the frigate, every Oliver Hazard class, Oliver Hazard Perry class frigate is an 11-compartment ship. You dog the hatches, and the ship is then separated into 11 watertight compartments. And so If you lose three, you are supposed to be able to stay afloat. If you lose four, nothing is going to save you from going to the bottom of the water. But here's the thing. The Roberts was among the very last of this very large class of ship, and every single passing year added more and more stuff on her. And because she was built to be a cheap ship back in the 70s, she was designed with only 50 tons of margin. And by the time they were building the Roberts in the 80s, it was literally 1,000 tons beyond that. So it's doubtful that Robert actually remained a three-compartment ship. He was probably more like a two-and-a-half-compartment ship. So the mine hits, and boom, floods the engine room. That's one compartment gone. Bam, blows out the propeller shield, to AMR 3, auxiliary machine room 3. That floods. Boom, that's two compartments gone. And there are holes in the forward bulkhead of the engine room, and AMR 2 starts flooding. And if they lose that, if that even gets fairly well flooded, Roberts is probably going down. So a damage control team charges down there, and they start plugging the holes. And everybody learns, every sailor learns at damage control school or even boot camp, that you've got these wooden wedges, and you can pound them into the holes, and that will reduce the water flow. Well, they started doing that on the Roberts, and what happened was every time they pounded one in, the metal just split further. And so, thankfully, they remembered their training, and they remembered that when that happens, there is more than just a little water behind a bulkhead. In order to split when you do that, there's got to be just ship-breaking amounts of water there. And so they stopped. And so they said, okay, well, what do we do now? And so they started taking off their clothes. They took off their coveralls and their shirts and their socks. They started stuffing these sock patches in. And that was starting to help, but not nearly enough. And so there was a chief down there, Kevin Ford, who was actually the chief cook, but he, like everybody else, had trained damage control so much that he probably figured he was a hoseman himself. But he was the guy who was directing traffic down there. And he said, okay, we need soft patches that are larger than coveralls. What do we have on the ship? He said, I got it. All right, everybody, you go get mattresses off your chief's racks, and you get them down here pronto, and we're going to stuff those in the holes. And this was brilliant. First of all, it was quite something to have your head above you and head about you enough to think of it. And second of all, it was a brilliant move because it was a morale booster. This was in the middle of this dire situation. It was, oh, yeah, we're going to have fun with our chiefs, too. It was just a remarkable, remarkable thing. And equally as remarkable was the fact that the crew managed to move fast enough to get the mattresses down there. And then they started bracing them with the 4x4 timbers they had. And then finally the steel extensible timbers that you have on a ship. And so they managed to start plugging the holes. And then came the deductors and the dewatering machinery and the pumps. And, after maybe a half hour, 45 minutes, they had finally stanched the flow. And at that point, that was another turning point. Like Tilly, getting the generator back online, was Chief Ford and his crew down in AMR-2 plugging the holes with the chief's mattresses. So all this speaks to the human element that you brought up. There is no machine who is going to think, oh, I know what we can do because the correct procedures aren't working. We can go get the chief's mattresses. There's just no way. So are we going too far to automation? Are we unnecessarily writing off ships because we're not putting enough people on board? I guess really only time will tell. All we can do is say, when we have seen ships in extremis, it has been the human element who has saved them.
Brad, we have on the line Tom Rennert, an old shipmate from the Samuel B. Roberts. Like to call in with, I think, a point of order and also a question. Tom, you're on with Brad.
Hi, Brad. Senior Chief Gunner's Mate here. You kind of covered everything because I was going to mention the mattresses that they came up, took out of the chief's mess. You just can't replace the human element on a ship. You can automize everything you want, but the human element is what helped save that ship. It was a good ship to start with. Pat built a really good ship. But some of the things we did, automation would have not stopped putting out the fire to keep from sinking. They'd have just kept sprinklers on it, where we had the permanent.
Let me break in just to tell you, just to fill people in on this, because you're absolutely right, and I'll let you make the point. But the one of the important things to note is that when the water was still coming into AMR 2, the ship was going down even faster than everybody expected, and so it took basically a V8 moment, and Captain Rin realized that because the firefighting effort was going on, the ship was pumping on gallon after gallon after hundreds of gallons of seawater to try to fight the fires, and that was sinking the ship just as fast as the water coming in from the engine room was. So soon after the firefighting effort had properly started, Rin said, "Stop fighting the fires." And of course, you know, what a terrible moment that was to just watch the fires blaze up. But it was absolutely necessary because they were going to sink it if they didn't stop it. So that's why stopping the flooding was doubly crucial in AMR-2. So that's what Gunnar Reinhardt is saying. So I'm sorry to interrupt. Go ahead.
No, that's fine, Brad. I'm just trying to make the point that the automation that we have in today's Navy is wonderful, but it's the sailors, the deck sailors, that make the things happen, and you need that decision and that training. Because without it, our ship, I know, would have sank. I mean, if it was all automated and we were just sitting back and watching automation work, it wouldn't have been good. So a lot of great sailors on that ship that day. And I appreciate the effort you put on that book, Brad. I really do.
Well, Tom, you know, it's your story, and it's your guy's story, and that's what it is. And, you know, everybody should be proud of what you did, and I am humbled every day by having the opportunity to write it.
And, Senior, thanks a lot for calling in. We really appreciate it. And 25 years late, probably seems like yesterday to you, but thanks again for all the effort and the example that you and your crew set.
Thank you.
And Eagle One, I think the next question is over to you.
Yeah, I want to go back to human element because a couple of the stories in the book are too good to pass up. One of them is Gordon Van Hook crawling through a limited space to try and find out where the fire was and find it in a stack. Can you describe that, discuss that a little bit for a minute?
Yeah, so when the mine hit, it set a lot of things on fire. The super hot gases that are created by the explosion went into the engine room through the hull, created a truck-sized hole in the hull into the engine room, and then blasted into the gas turbine modules, and from there went up through the ship in two ways. It went up through the intake plenums, the things that bring air down to the engines, and it went up, through the exhaust stack, which is, of course, where the exhaust vents. And so the super hot gas basically set fires on four decks as it went up. And as a matter of fact, then burst from the stack in this fireball that shot up dozens of feet above the ship and dropped flaming, lagging, and insulation all over the weather decks. So that is where the fire was by and large. And so there were teams of hosemen basically pouring water and AFFF down the stack and anywhere else they could find fire, but it was deep within the ship, and there really wasn't a good way to get at it. And so they'd been fighting this fire for about 3-4 hours when Gordon Van Hook said, "Look, there's something going on that we just can't reach by dropping water from above, so let's figure out what it is." So he and one of his enlisted guys opened up one of the hatches on the side of the stack and actually crawled in. And when he did that, they could then look down and see deep within this exhaust and intake complex what was going on. So they came back out, and Engineer Van Hook said, "Captain Wren, sir, I see the problem. I think what we need to do is take off one of these engine extraction plates." Shoot, that's the wrong name. But it's a plate that is literally bolted down with about 70 bolts onto the top of the superstructure of the frigate. And you take it off if you need to pull out one of your gas turbines. Gas turbine goes bad, you don't fix it in place. You can just pull it up and drop another one down in there. Wonderful things, gas turbines. And this was the access plate to it. And so Vin said, "Are you sure if we take this plate off, it seems like that might just allow more air to get to the fire, and then we'd be worse off." And Van Hook said, "That may well be, but in my judgment, it's the only way to get there. The fire is going to keep burning, even if we, even if we don't take this off. So Rim said, okay, that's fine. And this is a great little detail because everybody loves sailors, or everybody should love sailors for many reasons. But one of them is their MacGyver-like ability to just get things done. So literally, the access plate, I think I said, had about 70 bolts, and that's no exaggeration. And so when Rin told Van Hook to go ahead and take this plate off, Van Hook, when everybody tells me the story in the same way, basically he turned around and somehow sailors had rigged up enough wrenches and whatnot to get all this thing undogged and off. And so the speed was just incredible, and nobody could believe it to this day. But then they got crowbars under the lip of it, and they lifted it up, and sure enough, once they got about 2-3 inches of play there, the fire burst out and singed eyebrows and that sort of thing. And I think Van Hook at this point jokes, well, maybe that wasn't such a great idea. Maybe we should try this tomorrow. Ha, ha, ha. But they persisted, and they got it off. And indeed, as he had judged, that was the right way to access the fire. They were able to spray down to the fire, douse it, get it out, spray it so there were no reflashes. And that was essentially the final battle scene of this fight to save the Roberts. But once again, it's human initiative and human judgment that made the right call and contributed to the saving of the ship.
And Brad, we have another caller on that has a question for you. Caller, you're up.
Yeah, I'm on.
You're on. Go ahead. Okay, well, you're on with Brad.
Okay. Hey, Brad. I've been listening to everything, and I think you're doing a great job in the interview, and I think you've laid the story out online very well.
Thank you.
As well as you did in laying the story out in the book. I do want to make just one major comment about this, and that is this. Chief Reinitz's opinion is golden. The performance of the crew was absolutely spectacular, but the performance of the crew, and Brad touched on so many of them, but there were literally 50 or 60 more incidents which reflected their tremendous ingenuity. But it was the innovativeness of the sailors, their training, their preparation, and their knowledge of what the problems could be and how they could overcome it. And when I hear people talk about innovation and technology and going to automation, I have to tell you, I just don't buy it. And I don't buy it because of what we suffered and the loss of power and a lot of the problems that we went through. As Chief Ryan had said before, there wasn't any evaluation system that was going to come up and say, oh, boy, there must be another alternative. There just isn't. And there's no substitute for well-trained men. There's no substitute for good leadership at the chief's level and at the petty officer level. And I think there's no substitute for tremendous spirit in the crew and a belief in themselves. And I think the thing that saved Samuel B. Roberts quite clearly was all of those elements, but the fact that those sailors totally believed in themselves, believed in their ship, and were not going to sacrifice that ship that night and were willing to lose their lives to save it. There was lots of opportunities for sailors to leave that night. Nobody left. Of the numerous guys who were wounded and injured, when they were given the opportunity to depart the ship, they refused. They stayed and they fought it, and fought it brilliantly. So, Brad Penniston told the story, and he told it well, because he captured an awful lot of it. And I think the comments made by C.H. Reinert are on the money. I've enjoyed listening to you. But I think it's a great story and a great legend in the history of the Navy. And I think it's an example of how a group of men bonded together, well-trained, really come up and make the statement that great things happen when you have preparation meets opportunity. Although mining is not a lot of fun for opportunity, they certainly showed that they knew exactly what they were doing and how to deal with the problem.
And Colin, mind identifying yourself?
What? Oh, no, I'll identify. That was Captain Paul Rinn. He was the skipper on board the Roberts, the plank owner, and the guy who put it all together. So I think we're pretty lucky to have him calling in.
Yeah, Skipper, I really to you and Brett. I know you've both dealt with it, is when you tell the story of the Samuel B. Roberts and her crew and how they fought to keep the ship, what type of, may not have been familiar with the story, what do they want to know about the most? Is it a material issue? Is it a leadership issue? Is it just damage control 101? You know, Skipper, what do people really
Well, I think it all starts with, quite honestly, if you were to take all the chiefs and all of the officers on that ship, we wanted to be the best. We wanted to do everything better. It wasn't just damage control. I think there's a sense after this happened that people said, well, boy, you're really good at damage control. No, SG Bryant, we shot the heck out of anything we ever shot at. We hit everything we ever shot torpedoes at. We hit everything we ever shot missiles at. We were always on time. We won all the battles, and we were a really great group. And the crew was really united, and they were professional. They studied their jobs. They were proud of their shit. And so if you're asking me what is the most important thing, I think it's pride and professionalism. They were proud of their ship. They had a tremendous sense that they were the best and they could match up with anybody. They enjoyed the fact that they were representing their country in the Gulf, and they were driving off guys that were hurting people and killing people, and they were doing the right thing. And that's in that sense, coupled with the sense of heritage that the name Samuel B. Roberts brought to the ship, I believe was a resounding issue. And I don't know if Brad brought it up because I was about 5 minutes late tuning into this, but we just had a reunion that C.H. Ryan coordinated and ran down in Jacksonville. We had a tremendous turnout. We had almost 70% of the crew came back 25 years later and brought their wives and their families and just reflected a tremendous amount of pride, a tremendous amount of togetherness. It was really a tremendous thing. The thing that really resonated was the tremendous level of professionalism and the belief and everything they did. And I will always point to that as saying that's the thing that kept that ship afloat that night. I speak at MIT at the end of the month. It's my 10th year doing it. They haven't figured out yet how we kept the ship afloat. I keep telling them it's the sailors.
Yeah, the hard, stiff back of the sailor can accomplish many things for both good and things that wind up at mast. Brad, same question over to you.
Well, I'm not sure I could add that much to what Captain Rin said. I guess looking at it from the perspective of someone who tried to reassemble the little bits afterwards, I guess I'm just struck by the fact that everybody on a crew has their own job to do, and it's often something that you focus on. You have to learn it. It's a technical thing. It requires skill. It requires repetition. And you might not quite figure out how it fits into the bigger part of it. And I am struck by people, again, who come up and say, gosh, I didn't quite realize when I was fighting the fire up there what was going on down below. Or, I didn't quite realize that while I was evacuating the 76-millimeter magazine that other people were doing stuff up on the weather deck and this sort of thing. So it was really my great pleasure to put it all together so that it could be told in sort of a seamless, holistic fashion.
Yeah, I want to thank, like Sal did, Captain Rin for joining us today. Impressive training program that probably saved the ship and certainly speaks highly of the thoughts he had on command. One other side of this story, which we haven't covered yet, is the recovery of the ship itself. The immediate response of some agencies was that the ship was going to be a total loss, and yet the Roberts came back and sailed again. And I think that part of the story is a little undertold because it's not quite as dramatic as obviously human beings facing a life and death situation. But for those of us who have been on ship, they have a life of their own, and I think you tell it well. Can you go over the effort to save this ship and how Bath Iron Works innovated itself and created a way to put it back together?
Sure. Well, The decision to save the ship, I think, was made almost immediately. You had admirals in Washington giving press conferences where they said, no, we're going to bring her back and we're going to fix her, which, you know, I think was absolutely the right decision. You know, clearly the ship has had lots of deployments and plenty of life in her since, and I think just as a statement that we, the United States, and we, the United States Navy, are not going to allow a little thing like 600 pounds of TNT detonating and breaking our keel stop us from getting this warship back online. So the ship was towed into Dubai second day after the mine. It was put up on blocks. Assessments were made. She was deemed to be seaworthy. She was floated back out, lifted by a heavy lift ship by the name of the Mighty Serpent, and basically piggybacked all the way back to Newport, Rhode Island, which was the ship's home port. And there it stayed while Bath Iron Works prepared to receive it. The ship was duly towed up to Bath Iron Works and floated there on a dry dock that had been built in World War II and had seen service in the Pacific. So it had traveled from wherever it was built, I think maybe San Diego, maybe Seattle, I'm not entirely sure, but it had gone across the Pacific, had come back around the Pacific, had been sold to the state of Virginia. Bath Iron Works picked it up for $1 and maintenance costs, came up to Portland, and became the ship repair facility. So this even the dry dock has a tremendous story to tell. Anyway, so the Roberts gets put up on blocks, and the repair itself was intricate and technical. They had to cut out from the bottom a section of the engine room and basically forge a brand new module to put underneath it. And really, the Roberts was about the first class of ship where this was possible, you give or take a few classes, because she was one of the first ones built with modular design technology. That is to say, instead of being built on the waves as, you know, like you see the keel first and the ribs around her and then the skin of the ship and all that sort of stuff, instead, the Roberts had been built in blocks, like giant Lego blocks almost, 36 of them, where you would then take the bow, and you'd attach it to the section just behind the bow, and you'd attach that to the section just behind that, and block upon block, it made shipbuilding much faster and much more efficient. And when it came to repairing the Roberts, it was pretty easy, because instead of having to redesign this whole section, you could basically reconstitute the damaged modules. And so that's what they did. They rebuilt the modules, and then they rented a crane. Actually, they didn't own a crane heavy duty enough to take this module, but they took it from Bath and brought it down to Portland. They placed it next to the Roberts, and they slowly jacked it into place and up into place, and they welded it all shut. And so then the question is, all right, so we've done that. It looks great, but is she going to run? And as a matter of fact, the folks at Bath had taken such pride in making this repair, they had actually adopted the motto "better than new," and in fact, that's what the Robert was. She actually ran faster after the repair than she had on her sea trials 4 or 5 years earlier. So it really was a terrific piece of work by Bath Iron Works, and it displayed a lot of pride by the shipyard and by the Navy to make this all happen. It really was the biggest repair job ever undertaken in Maine, if you want to think of it that way. But on a national level, it just represented a "we can't be beaten" type of attitude.
Brad, we're in theory just have a minute left in normal time, but it keeps recording, and people can catch it on the archive. I want to take a couple minutes to wind things up, because I'm always, and again, as an author, I think you can appreciate this point, that when you do things, it sends a message. And these messages have second and third order effects. They have a dwell time. And we sent a big message, I think, to the Navy, but also to the outside world with the fact that we took the Sammy B back. We've got her put back together, made her better than new that put out there. But on top of that, when it was discovered why the mine was where it was, that the Sammy B. Roberts hit, as a nation, we decided to send a message on how we respond to such things. I wonder if you could take a couple of minutes and connect everybody to a couple of occasions that they may know about, but they may not have continuity of what happened as a response to the mining of the Samuel B. Roberts and as far as what our fleet did.
Right. Well, immediately the Navy had dive teams in the water going after the mines, and they pulled the mines up and they looked at the serial numbers and they looked at the make and the model, and they matched a set of mines that was seized about, I think it was about 6-7 months earlier, after an earlier mining in the Gulf. In I think it was September, October 1987, U.S. Navy SEALs seized an Iranian mine layer and captured it, took it lock, stock, and barrel, seized the mines on board, and so they were able to determine that the mines that got the Samuel B. Roberts were, in fact, Iranian mines. So there was no question at all as to who had done it. The question was, what shall we do? And a whole range of possibilities were considered. There, you know, should we just do a show of force? Should we actually go to war with Iran? Should we do something in between? So everybody got to work. Tony Less, the admiral who controlled the Middle East force in the Persian Gulf, got his staff working on plans. People in Washington dusted off all manner of plans that they had. And the first thing that sort of floated to the top was, well, we should take out some oil platforms. And I think it was Admiral Crow, then the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who said, well, we did that last autumn when somebody shot a silkworm at a tanker in port. We've got to do something more serious and weighty. And so the plan got upgraded to, okay, take out these oil platforms, and also you can sink one major Iranian warship. And so that was the plan going forward. 4 days after the mining, this is 18 April 1988, the U.S. formally launched Operation Praying Mantis. And this was explicitly retaliation for the mining of the Samuel B. Roberts. And it began at 8 in the morning. Two groups of U.S. warships approached a gas oil separation platform, loud hailed the people on board, the Iranians on these platforms, said, you know, get off, evacuate immediately. I intend to destroy you. And one of the platforms, as a matter of fact, did evacuate immediately. The other fired up a couple of anti-aircraft guns and shot, at which point it was Katie bar the door, and the U.S. retaliated. Ultimately, both of the platforms were destroyed, one by gunfire that ignited fuel tanks on the platform, the other by a team of Marines, I think it was, who actually went and set detonators and blew the platform up. So that was the early phase of Operation Praying Mantis. Then the question was the Iranian Navy going to come out and fight? And nothing happened for a few hours until the missile boat Joshan appeared, and she actually steamed up to a couple of the U.S. Navy ships and unleashed their harpoon, one of the harpoons that had been sold by the U.S. to the Shah of Iran back in the days of monarchy. And so at that point, the U.S. Navy retaliated, and through missiles and gunfire, sank the Joshan. That did not count against the quota of one major Iranian warship, both because the missile boat was kind of small. It was not the frigates that the U.S. was actually after, and because she had shot first. So that didn't count. You could actually go off and sink another one, was the message given to the rest of the force. So the U.S. actually sank another frigate, the Sabalan, and damaged the Sahand, unless I've got those two mixed up. Anyway, damaged another frigate and sank another frigate. And at that point, they waved it off. Washington said, okay, no more. That's enough. We've made our point. We have the combat power of the Iranian Navy. That's enough for one day. There was one other aspect to this. Some more Iranian assets that were destroyed. They were little power boats called Boghammers. And in the middle of the day, these had left their ports on Abu Musa, an island in the middle of the Persian Gulf that Iran controlled, and were running around machine-gunning enemy oil platforms and boats and a U.S.-flagged ocean-going tug and a couple of other things. And this was not in the plan at all. So The local commanders called up Middle East Force, who called up Central Command, who called up Washington, who called up the White House, called up President Reagan, and said, what can we do about these boats? They're not attacking U.S. Assets, but they are, you know, they're shooting people. And so Reagan made the decision quickly, and it came down the chain of command, yeah, go after those power boats. And so duly they were. There were a couple of A-6s that lifted off the aircraft carrier Enterprise, and with Lockeye cluster bombs took out these little power boats that were machine gunning things. And the significance of that is that they're twofold. One, it was the first concrete step towards a general U.S. policy of protecting non-U.S. assets in the Persian Gulf, which arose in the weeks later. But two, it also marked sort of the modern era of Washington and the White House and the president being available for and then making tactical level decisions. And, you know, some people will say, this is awful, and some people will say it was great, and some people will say it's in between, but nevertheless, it marked a turning point. We had these communications and these systems that will allow us to do that, and so this is the inevitable result. We have to call all the way to the president to get a decision made. So, you know, that's what happened after the Samuel B. Roberts. Those are some of the effects. And I guess I will close with two more thoughts. One is that Professor Craig Simons, who wrote about Operation Praying Mantis, pointed out that it really was the precursor to the American, to today's American networked way of war. You know, right now, of course, when we go to war with an incredible array of command, control, communications, intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance, assets, and radio networks to keep us all on the same page and tell us where we are, what we are targeting, and what we're doing, what friendly and unfriendly forces are doing. And Praying Mantis was the prototype. This was the first time that the U.S. had gone to war with this kind of networked ability. And compared to what we have today, it's rather primitive. But on the other hand, you had Hawkeyes in the air, E-2s telling the American aircraft where to go. You had AWACS, Air Force AWACS, kind of giving everybody the God's eye view. You had constant radio communication between all the vessels. And then, of course, you had that chain of command that could go all the way up to the president to get a tactical decision made. And so Simons points out that this was really the prototype. This said, okay, we've built these systems, and they seem to work okay. That's one lesson out of Praying Mantis. Another lesson, I think, out of the Samuel D. Roberts is, despite all this high-tech stuff, you can have all the high-tech stuff in the world, and yet, what got the Samuel B. Roberts? It was a very simple, dumb, cheap, cost less than $1,000, followed a design made in 1906 for the Tsarist Navy in Moscow, naval mine. That is what put a $96 million hole in the Samuel B. Roberts and, you know, laid low that U.S. warship. So you can look at the story of the Samuel B. Roberts and Operation Praying Mantis as the triumph of technology, but you also must look at it as a lesson in what simple tools and people can still do in warfare.
Well, those are great points, Brad. Let me thank you again for coming on the show with us today. Before I let you go, what are we going to see from you in the future? You've got a project that we can see coming down the pathway?
Well, Armed Forces Journal, which I edit, is turning 150 years old in August. It was founded, it put out its first issue on August 29th, 1863. It was founded by a Union Army officer who'd been a newspaperman and then done a stint in the Union Army, fought in a couple battles, was wounded, got out to found a publication that would become a place for the professionalizing military to get together and discuss issues of importance to the community and to the conduct of warfare. So that was the Army-Navy Journal, and it has been through 10 different owners and 10 different name changes, but today it is run by the Army Times Publishing Company or you know, by their corporate parent, Gannett, and it is turning 150 years old in August. So we are celebrating it by putting out an anthology of some of the greatest hits from AFJ over the 150 years. So there's you know, there's stuff that's prescient, like articles arguing about the skirmish line, this brand new tactic that was coming out of the Civil War. And there are articles that show just how dumb we can be, like George Patton's passionate embrace of the cavalry saber and his, you know, his talking about how this cavalry saber I've designed will change warfare. And, of course, we know how that worked out for him, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And AFJ has been part of the great discussion, you know, for 150 years. And so this new anthology, which I'm editing, is hopefully going to show that. And again, we've good and, you know, good and interesting, I hope.
Well, that definitely sounds like brain candy. Thanks again, Brad, and I really appreciate you taking time this Sunday. And I really hope you get the response that we really should have for the paperback and the Kindle version of No Higher Honor. It really, like a couple of our callers who were on board the ship say, and I think as you outlined quite well, it may have been a quarter of a century ago, but the lessons are very germane right now and today. So thank you very much for all the work you've done, and I look forward to seeing some more down the road.
Well, I appreciate you having me on the podcast. You guys are doing a great job. Appreciate it very much.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much. And thank you, everybody, who are joining us here on the archive. We hope to see you again on the next episode of Midrats. Cheers.
Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same.
It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go, it's a long way to Tipperary. It's a long, long way to Tipperary.